interviewing Jim Rome, on a Vietnam vet, on May 30th, 2001. So, we'll start with the veterans ones. And what was your life like before the war?
Well, before the war, I was a college student. It was a great time. It was a good... one thing that I've thought about a lot was that I was, I was on athletic teams that always won, and very few losing teams. Was used to winning, got good grades in school. I was in ROTC at Oregon State, and after my sixth year, I had to graduate because what happened was when I was a senior, there was a war in Laos and Vietnam that was a guerrilla war that we seemed to be getting involved in. I had already joined the infantry in ROTC, so I thought maybe if I went to grad school, it'd be over by the time I got out. So I got a year's deferment, what they call it, and then another one because it wasn't over, and then the Army said, "No, you're not staying in school any longer." So I just entered the Army, and that was a little different.
Okay, so I've been used to. So did the draft laws affect you at all?
Yeah. The only reason why I joined ROTC, there's a couple reasons. One was all my friends were. But you had to deal with the draft somehow. I mean, this is so hard to relate to now because it's a volunteer armed services, but then it wasn't. And so there was a draft, even though we weren't in a war. And you had to deal with it. There was no lottery. Your name went down to the draft board, and depending on the size of the community that you come from, or the county, and I came from Seaside, which is a pretty small county, so and they had a pretty high quota compared to how many people lived there. So you're probably going to get drafted if you weren't married or working for some defense industry or something like that. So everybody either joined the National Guard, or they joined ROTC, or they did something. I was in ROTC simply because I didn't want to be a private. And there wasn't a war going on. And then during the college years, the Gulf of Tonkin incident was my first year in grad school. And by the time I entered the Army, they were sending units.
And what branch of the military did you enter into?
Army Infantry.
Okay, so how did you feel about entering into the war?
Well, I grew up, I was a little kid during the Second World War. And so I really expected to go to war. All of my life, I expected there would be another war and that I would have to go because everybody went to the Second World War unless they were too old or blind or, there were very few people that didn't do it, or men. It was just, didn't even faze me. I went into the Army, I was stationed in Texas, and there were units over in Vietnam, two big ones, and I pretty much expected, since I was an infantry officer, that I would be called. And about 9 months after I entered active duty, I simply got a call on the phone from our main office saying, "Your orders are here." And it didn't really, I was really pretty excited about it because that's what I've been trained to do.
Okay.
So it didn't really depress me. I wasn't really happy about maybe possibly dying or be wounded or something like that, but I was still excited about it.
Just the fact that you're getting to go to war.
Well, do what I was, do what I was trained to do rather than sit around Fort Sam Houston, Texas and do nothing, which was really awful. All
right. Okay, so what was the trip to Vietnam like?
Well, I went to Panama first and was trained in jungle warfare. Everybody going to the 1st Cavalry, E7 and above, that was in a combat unit, had to go to Panama first. And then I came home for 30 days on leave, and it was like a 21-hour flight with no windows in the plane. Like 17 hours to Wake Island, and then another few hours over to the Philippines. It was just like, we were just like cargo. There was no windows. Most guys were asleep. I went up to the flight deck and sat around with the pilots. it was kind of cool. Couldn't see anything. We were flying over the ocean. I mean, it was just a bunch of water and clouds.
And how long did you actually stay in Vietnam?
A year.
A year? Okay. And while you were there, did you receive any gifts or anything, like packages from your hometown or anything like that?
Well, when I was there, I wrote to people I didn't know. I had names given to me of girls back home, that sort of thing. You know, so I wrote lots of letters whenever I had a chance, and you know, just like a page, just real fast. And so I got lots of letters, and every letter I got from my brother had a package of Kool-Aid in it, because the treated water that I was out in the jungle the whole time, the whole year. The water was just undrinkable because it had halazone in it, you know, it'd kill all the bacteria and protozoa. So you'd put Kool-Aid in it. I got packages at Christmas from my family. That was it.
Okay, and
soap.
Yeah. And so do you have any interesting stories to tell?
I got lots of them, but I don't really tell them. War stories embarrass me. And the stories that I have to tell are like people tell when they're in a cocktail party and they start talking about accidents they've seen on the freeway and they start one-upping each other. Well, you know, wait till you hear what I saw one time. And if you're sitting there in a party like that, what are you supposed to do? Well, you ought to have been with me when I saw somebody blown in half, you know, or the guy next to me. I mean, there's no time. There's no situation where you're going to want to tell those stories. And nothing else is of any interest to anybody. It's pretty embarrassing stuff, because most of the time if you hear somebody telling a war story, it's a fabrication. Or at the very best, it has been embellished on over the years.
Let me see.
I really haven't talked about it for 30 years, 25 years. I mean, with some, you know, there's some humorous thing that happened that I'll be glad to tell people, but
okay,
just don't really talk about it much.
And what was it like returning home from the war?
Well, that was really interesting, because most of the officers in infantry units were rotated out of the field. You know, like 6 months they were in the field, and then they would be put in some other job. And I wasn't. I was just left out there. I think they needed somebody to become an executive officer that knew what was going on, and I was never going to become company commander because I was never going to achieve a high enough rank. I mean, I was only in for 2 years. So, I mean, I just stayed out there. I was platoon leader for most of the time that I became executive officer of the company, and by the time it was time for me to rotate back home, I had diarrhea, I was sick, I couldn't sleep at night because I had heard so many stories about people getting killed the day they're supposed to leave the field. And that certainly would have been kind of hard to take. And so at the very end, when I was ready to leave the field, I was in a pretty bad shape, just because I was so worked up about it. And 2 or 3 days later, I was home. I was in Oakland. You fly into Travis Air Force Base, which is just outside of Oakland, California, go into a room, sit down with a bunch of other guys, and a representative from the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and they give you an orientation about what it's going to be like to not be in the Army, because I got out of the Army the minute I got back home. That's when my tour of duty was magically up. And so we walked out of that room. I had my uniform on, and I walked down the streets of Oakland. I think they bussed us into Oakland to a motel or something like that. And I remember walking down the streets of Oakland and thinking, this is too strange. People wouldn't look at me. There was no eye contact at all. I felt really weird. And so I got back to the motel, took the uniform off, and put my civvies on, of which I had like one pair of pants and one shirt that had been somewhere in a bag for a year. And it was just weird. Just a couple of days ago, you know, I was actually in the jungle. They were hauling dead bodies out of where I was in cargo nets on Chinook helicopters. cargo nets full of dead bodies out of my unit. And then I backhauled myself on one of the Hueys, and a couple of days later I was walking around Oakland, and it was like nothing was going on. It was really hard to adjust to. You know, there's a real adjustment going into war from being, because it's like there's nothing happening in San Francisco and Oakland. Those places just like, you know, normal. And then all of a sudden, you're in a different universe, actually not a different world, just a completely different universe. The paradigm's really different. In Oakland, if somebody came out and shot you, they'd be arrested and put away for the rest of their life. And then, but this other universe, somebody can come out and shoot you and they will be given a medal. They'll be hailed as a hero. So it is a real different deal. People, I don't know if you've ever thought about that, but that changes literally everything. And to come back home and to be walking down the street, or, you know, being in a restaurant and having normal activity going on around, people behaving as, you know, they normally would, is kind of odd. And, you know, the Second World War, they brought units over in mass and they left them there. You're going to be here until the war's over or until you're wounded or killed. And then they brought them back in mass. So, I mean, the whole unit comes back and everybody has a parade and everybody's happy. But the Vietnam War, and I think the Korean War too, people rotated. You put in a 1 year tour of duty. And it was staggered because people, their tours ended at different times. And so there are people flying back home, you know, a plane load of GIs, you know, one Boeing 747 full of GIs coming back every day. Well, people get kind of used to that. It isn't the same. So, I mean, you just enter the flow, and it's pretty odd. There was no way that you could honor people as they returned under those circumstances. I mean, there was just no way to do it. Even if the Americans wanted to do it, there would have been no way to do it. You'd have had to have a band and a parade standing, you know, that was always there in Oakland every day, plus crowds. I mean, that wouldn't happen.
And so when you got back to your hometown, how did you? Is the same thing?
Yeah. Everything's normal. Just, you know, you're there. And everything's normal. I mean, it's like nothing's happening, or it had happened. I mean, when you hear people talk about the Vietnam War, they say that it was really, it was on TV every night, and people became very upset about it, and it angered them. There was a big anti-war movement. I didn't see it that way. I mean, yeah, it was on TV every night, just like right now. You turn on TV, and they lead with a couple of auto accidents, you know. You get pretty used to it. And I think people were just used to it. And there were, you know, there were a lot of people who were very upset about it. And but really, to be honest with you, not in Hillsborough, not in Seaside, not in these, you know, small towns. And Hillsborough was a much smaller town then. Pretty conservative place, still is, but I mean, it was more conservative then, more of a farming community. And so there really wasn't anybody around that was screaming and yelling to stop the war in Hillsborough, except maybe Jack Kirkwood. He was really screaming, but he was really a lone voice out there. He was the only one. Every time the newspaper would come out, there'd be a letter to the editor from Jack, that'd be it. I mean, he was very upset about it, but in my memory, really, it wasn't pervasive at all. Nobody seemed to care.
All right, and how do you feel, like, the people, like, treated you or thought of you? Do you think they were, like, you know, did they think they thought of better of you for being in the war or nothing at all? Or
well, what? People my age who had grown up, you know, in the first 5 years of my life, there was a war going on. And I think people my age felt like shaking my hand. Not that they did. People younger than me that hadn't had that, like say were born from 1945 on, the baby boomers, most of them I think thought I was stupid for doing it, as though I had a choice, which I didn't feel I did. And if I was given a choice, well, I wouldn't have chose to do that, you know. that would have not been something I wanted to do. There was no reason to do it. I can't understand why anybody would have joined the Army for the purpose of going to war in Vietnam, wherever that is. I mean, really, nobody even knew where it was back then. It could have been in Australia. It could have been on the North Pole. People didn't know where it was. I knew there was an area of the world called Indochina because the French had been having problems there for years. But I wasn't real sure where it was. So, I mean, I would never have volunteered to go help those people to fight communism. I didn't care about communism. It didn't make any difference to me. Nobody could ever convince me that the U.S. would have been taken over by a form of government. So there would be no sale there. I would never have chosen to do it. But still, I think those people thought that I was just stupid for having done it.
Okay. You know,
because they felt they had the option. They could burn their draft card. They could not go. They could be a protester. I didn't.
Okay, and so do you think that it played any part in you being able to get a job once you came back?
No. The fact that I was a vet, I don't know. You'd have to ask the people that hired me. I think, for one thing, when I came back, they were clamoring for teachers. Teachers were in short supply, and jobs were in, there were lots of jobs. I remember I didn't even think about working when I got back. I just kind of said, the heck with it, I'm just not going to do anything. I did my part. Now I'm just going to sit back. And finally, my dad got tired of paying the bills and said, you got to go to work. And this was like August 20th. And I was trained to be a teacher. Well, it was a little late to be looking for a job when schools all start. You know, they usually have a week in August, at the end of August. But sure enough, I activated my file at Oregon State to have them send out to schools that needed teachers, and I just got tons of calls. They really needed somebody. So I don't think my being a vet made any difference at all. The fact that I was there and I was, you know, 98.6 degrees was fine with it. It was easy to get a job.
Okay. And in your opinion, did the students that you dealt with, did they, were there...
I think they thought it was neat. They knew. Sometimes they would ask questions about it. You know, but you know, I don't think the students that I was teaching envisioned that it would involve them. And really it didn't. I started teaching 16-year-olds in 1968. And if the last ground combat units were out of there in 71. So, a couple, 3 years. So, I mean, it didn't involve them. They unless they already had a brother or a father that was over there, it was a pretty detached deal. And you know how teenagers are. They think about today. They think about, you know, the dance tonight. Nobody's changed. That's the way teenagers have always been. They don't think, well, geez, you know, if we're not out of there in another 3 years, I might be there myself. This sounds pretty serious. I don't think that was... I mean, you could have told them that, you know, and there was a senior class called Modern Problems. It's kind of the late 60s version of econ and people in politics. I'm sure they got told, but I don't think that, you know, I don't think they really... connected to it. Didn't believe it.
Okay, and so did the students become like rebellious or were there...
Not mine.
Anti-war, anti-draft kind of...
Actually, things? The whole world was changing a little bit. You may not believe this, but it's true. The world is closer today to what it was like with me in high school than it was then. And that was only like 15 years later, or 10 years later. I graduated in 59 from high school. I started teaching in Hillsborough High School in 68, so it was 9 years later, and it was so different. And the next year, 69, was even more different. In all the early 70s, everything had changed. And, I mean, it was just different. And things have kind of gradually swung back to the way they were when I was in high school, which is a lot more clean cut and I mean, you don't, I know students don't think of themselves as being more, less rebellious now than they were then, but they are much less rebellious than they were then. And I think big part of it was the war. They saw it was okay for people to scream and yell at their government and at the, at any authority. And so they didn't see any problem in maybe not screaming and yelling, but maybe being a little bit defiant. But in my classroom, they were absolutely just like any other kid ever was. Didn't feel any of it. But you know, the weird part was the year I got there, 1968, was, I mean, people will tell you this, that was one of the biggest years in the history of this country. Tons of things happened. There was a huge presidential election that fall. And even bigger than that, there was a senatorial election at the same time, and Wayne Morse was unseated by Bob Packwood. And there were people on both sides of that were furious at each other. And Bob Kennedy had just been assassinated that previous summer. And Martin Luther King was, I think, had just been assassinated or was getting ready to be. Things were just a little tense. People stopped. I mean, I didn't have any clothes I could wear to work. People stopped dressing up. They started dressing down to go places. And so eventually, teachers started looking like kids in the classroom. They were wearing sandals instead of shoes and jeans, and that was unheard of prior to that. Everybody wore a coat and a tie, and ladies all had dresses on. That kind of gradually, over a year's time, 68 to 69, just changed. So the world changed. And it had to do with the war, but really it was more fashion to most people.
And so on the fashion topic, were there kinds of music that they were listening to? Did that change at all? Or
music that I was listening to changed. Actually, it started changing prior to my coming back, but I would say there was a big folk music wave in the mid-60s, and then it got electrified and got moved into the pop music scene. And folk music has always been kind of people's music, and so the lyrics were different. They were no longer about teen love and that sort of thing. They were more about standing up for yourself and anti-war, it was pervasive. But that had started before I left, and when I came back, it was in full swing. Really different. And that had a lot to do with the popular culture changing too.
Okay. And were the teachers at all teaching about the war? Were they?
Yeah. Well, certainly Mr. Kirkwood was. And there was another teacher the year I came who disappeared at the end of the year, and I think, I would only be guessing, his name was Doug Nicolai, and he taught social studies also. And he was always upset, and his students were always upset. And at the end of the year, since he was a probationary teacher, it was in his second year. The first 3 years in those days was probationary, and you could be non-renewed for cause. You didn't have to go through the rigmarole of actually firing you, which a teacher that's been there for more than 3 years, it kind of takes a little work to do that, but not, I mean, Doug just at the end of that first year that I was there just was dismissed. And I don't know what it was for. It's, it's a personnel matter, they'll never tell you, but all of us guessed that he had been way too into this thing with his students. And I'm sure that had to do with it. But you're teaching, you've got a curriculum. I can't imagine an English teacher teaching about the war, but social studies teachers, they had an in social studies.
Okay. Have you heard of a thing called a moratorium?
I know what a moratorium is.
Okay, when they taught Overhill High, they had a thing, a whole day where they just taught about Vietnam War, no matter what teacher, what subject it was. Mm. Did anything like that occur?
No. No.
Okay.
They divided the district into two grades in the junior highs, which are now the middle schools, two grades at a place called the Mid High, which is the Thomas Building now, and two grades at Hillsborough High School. So, and since I taught biology, I had sophomores, I was in the Mid High School. If they ever did anything like that, it would have been done at Hillsborough High School with the juniors and seniors. So, they have, in fact, I'm sure they did.
Okay, yeah, that's where it was. All right. And, let's see. And is there anything else, just to wrap it up, do you have any other things that you want to just say that you feel that I haven't asked about, do you think may be important?
No, you've done actually a pretty good job. As far as the war's effect on this community, you know, I don't think it involved a lot of young men from Hillsborough. And the reason why I say that is I didn't know anybody here that was in my boat. I felt like a lone wolf, you know. I was the only one I knew out here. And I only lived out here for 2 years. But I didn't know anybody that had been to war. Kind of one of those random things. Most of the guys in my... and another thing is this. Just going to Vietnam doesn't necessarily mean you have the wonderful experience of combat. I mean, it's like 1 out of 8 that's in a unit that gets involved in that. So I don't think there was you're probably finding this out. You're having a hard time finding veterans in this area. And then it's a very conservative, kind of a religious community in those days. So there was not a lot of anti-war sentiment either. Those people of that bent just aren't going to do that. They are more in line with what's going on by the very nature of who they are. So there really wasn't much here. All you had to do was drive into Portland, or certainly down to San Francisco or Oakland or Berkeley, where there's more a more liberal community, and you ran into it. It was pervasive. Not out here. People were generally very nice to me. I occasionally got into conversations the first few years with people who, like Mr. Kirkwood and I, had several talks. But he's no fool. The man was very intelligent, and he understood that I had nothing to do with this war. I had just been ordered into it, and that really I knew less than he did. I could give him first-hand experiences and that sort of thing, but really the guy out there with a gun in his hand doesn't know what's going on. Nobody's going to tell him what's going on. The only way you're going to find out anything is through the newspaper that the military actually publishes, called the Stars and Stripes. The only newspaper you're going to get. You're going to get their viewpoint. And so I've always felt this way, that I didn't really find out about this war until I got home and started reading, you know, Time magazine and other newspapers, and watching television, getting a more broad viewpoint. But I really enjoyed talking to him. He's a very nice guy, and he was, you know, he was very eager to tell me how bad the war was, and I agreed with him. I mean, I actually thought it was pretty bad, too. When we were over there, I mean, when something terrible would happen, like several times, lots of guys in our unit were either killed or badly wounded. Lots of times, just what would seem like innocent civilians would be just massacred by what was going on. Not necessarily by, you know, us wanting to massacre them, but they're in the way. And when it was over, you just said, what are we doing? You know, this would be like, it's like a bunch of kids out playing kick the can after dark when you've been told by your parents that you weren't supposed to do that, and then a car comes by and runs somebody over. Now, how would you feel? You'd feel like an idiot. Well, that's kind of how I felt. Kind of like we're out playing some game,
you know, something that meant nothing, and bad things were happening. Not all the time, but I mean, and you certainly wouldn't know when it was going to happen, but then it would happen. And you'd just be kind of lost in thought, wondering what on earth you were doing. So, I mean, when Jack and I sat down, that, you know, it was like a year later and a little bit more. I mean, he was right. And I knew it. But on the other hand, I was living in a different world. I was kind of I didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether to tell people I was against the war or what. Because I was obviously part of it. I'd been there in the infantry of all things. So I didn't really know what to do. Shut up, I guess. Which is kind of what I did. And I think that's kind of the experience of a lot of vets. You know, they either got involved in Veterans Against the War, which was a big decision to make. You know, throw your medals at the Capitol steps or whatever you ended up doing. Either that or you shut up. There was no room for somebody to say, I'm for the war. It wasn't 6 months after I got home that it was obvious to me that there wasn't going to be anybody talking in favor of the war. I mean, they would sound like idiots. So they just didn't. Not even senators and congressmen. They just didn't do it.
All right.
That'll help you a little bit.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.